I would like to excuse me, echo Riley's shameless plug for the Index for Economic Freedom. It's an extraordinary publication. It's really unique. And if you haven't seen it, I would really recommend, you're here, so you have an active interest in the subject matter, you should check it out. It's a really unique piece of work, and it's extremely useful. I use my copies all the time. It's great in the moment, as well as having back copies to use as a resource. So anyway, I would concur with that. But thank you, Deepa, Richard, the Seeger Center, for your willingness to host today's event. I wonder what Gaston Seeger would make of all of what's going on with China at the moment. He would certainly be well equipped, in my view, to offer counsel to any president sitting in the White House at this juncture, given his expertise and the strength of the team that he worked with, Jim Lilly and David Locks and Wolfowitz and Armitage and others, who made up the core of George Shultz's Asia team. I believe that Gaston Seeger would certainly be a leader in promoting the interests of the United States in this present situation if he were alive today. I would like to just indulge for a second here. Over the past weekend, we lost a really great thinker and leader in U.S. Taiwan, or in Taiwan's economic past. Jiang Pinggong, or P.K. Zhang, was instrumental in the 1980s and 90s. In Taiwan's economic miracles, 6% plus growth year on year. PK, to those of us who had the privilege of knowing him, was an economic central planner, not in the Trotsky sense of it, but he played an extraordinary role in leadership, along with people like Xu Lider and Wang Zhigang, and of course Vincent Chao, over that period in charting Taiwan's economic miracle over 20 years. And his passing was a great loss. He did a tremendous job for his country, and he was a very good friend of the United States. So rest in peace, PK. I'm going to try and fold into some of the activities that the U.S. business community participate in respect to some of the things that Riley has mentioned and Deep pointed to as well. U.S.-Taiwan trade policy is honestly like being Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. It just seems like we've been stuck in the same day for years. We have been stuck in the same day for years. It is incredibly frustrating that we have failed today to elevate the relationship out of parochial differences and looked at it more through the prism of the strategic interests of both countries, which, by the way, are embedded in the Taiwan Relations Act. Our USTR's focus on agricultural issues, even if we accept on the face of it that they stand on solid ground, it's the position of the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council that they are now pursuing a failed strategy, that we've been at this for a decade, and that their approach has manifestly failed. So how do you satisfy the requirement to change the agricultural policies of Taiwan that allow for U.S. produce based on science to flow into the Taiwan market, solve that issue, and as a consequence then broaden out the potential for a far broader and robust conversation. For our membership, we want to see that happen in the worst way. Our membership is a broad cross-section of the U.S. economy and U.S. economic engagement. Our membership is heavily vested in the supply chain, so a lot of tech, both principals, systems integrators, as well as supply chain companies. And those companies want to see Taiwan grow. They want to see the supply chain operate smoothly. And they also want to ensure that they can operate within the Taiwan market, which as a market unto itself is also significant, right? Taiwan is one of the world's largest economies. It's a top 20 economy. It's a top 10 trading partner with the United States, and that belies its significance in the supply chain. Access to the Taiwan market is essential, and these parochial matters are getting in the way of opening up sectors like financial services, where I believe U.S. companies could thrive. The key players on either side, on the Taiwan side, the trade and economic leadership team, with trade as the sort of leader here, is President Tsai herself. She is, of course, a trade negotiator, first and foremost. Minister without portfolio, John Deng. Some of you know, I'm looking around the room, know John personally. Vice Minister for Economic Affairs, Wang Meihua. And then underneath Meihua is of course, the DG for the Bureau of Foreign Trade, Jenny Yang. Those four people make up the core of Taiwan's economic team. And frankly, they are world-class trade negotiators. I'm not just saying that because I'm fond of them personally. They are expert at what they do. But it's a bit like having the, you know, to use a sports metaphor, it's a bit like, you know, the Barcelona Olympics and having, you know, the US World Cup team there with Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley and all those guys and not letting them play. Right? What's the point in having them there if you don't let them play? Taiwan could be a significant player in global, bilateral, multilateral trade engagement if it were given an opportunity to do. It could be a leader if countries were prepared to see the opportunity inherent in engaging Taiwan in trade liberalization. And of course, separate of the challenge that Taiwan faces in engaging, look what Taiwan's doing anyway. They are a leader. Think what they could do if they were given an opportunity to lead in some of these economic opportunities. On the US side, the trade relationship has almost zero senior leadership. Instead, it is driven primarily by working level officials at USTR, State, and AIT. Good people all good people. However, in the absence of senior political capital to invest in the relationship, they don't have the opportunity to argue at a strategic level, well, or to make a case for more. And frankly, it's not their job to argue the strategic importance of the economic engagement. That is the job of people further up the decision-making chain. So we're stuck here until, in my view, we get leadership. And I do believe it's possible with Mr. Trump and his colleagues. We really have a unique opportunity. Mr. Bolton, Mr. Pompeo, to name but two outside of the traditional defense, and potentially Stilwell when he finally gets in at EAP. These personalities could play an important role in moving us beyond this position that we have. And they will have robust support from the organization that I represent. And I don't want to put words in Bill Foreman and AmCham Taipei's camp, but Bill and his colleagues who do excellent work, they too have been outspoken in their interest in seeing a free/fair trade agreement. On the private sector side, the tech supply chain is driving the relationship. Our main technology companies continue to rely heavily on Taiwan, with Taiwan companies doing much of the systems integration in China. You all know that. I'm looking around. You guys are aware of what's happening within the supply chain and the critical role that companies like Honhai play in integrating Apple products in China. Integrating, right? Honhai doesn't make all those products. They integrate all the different pieces that go into our phones and our iPads and all the goodies that we buy at Christmas and Hanukkah and those sorts of times. But nevertheless, Taiwan is a key player in that. That, of course, is the shift in the supply chain as we see it right now is accelerating. It started prior to Mr. Trump, frankly, with the rising in costs on the eastern side of China and along the eastern seaboard. As costs started to rise, companies started to move inland more in China, and you also started to see a stronger break towards Southeast Asia. Vietnam is an excellent example here. But the geostrategic tensions that have arisen since President Trump responded, in my view, I absolutely reject the notion that this is Trump's trade war. That's nonsense, in my view. It's not Trump's trade war. We have been attacked, in my view. The predatory practices of the PRC required our response. And if Mrs. Clinton or Mr. Trump had won, I still believe at some level we would be dealing at this moment with that predatory behavior. So we have we have a government at the moment here in the United States that is attempting to address that. I worry about Riley's comment a wee bit that he thinks things will be sorted out in 90 days. I hope not, because I don't believe that that will mean, if we accept what China puts forward in 90 days, I think we're going to end up with a very poor deal. Because I do agree with Riley when he says that the structural issues that we're dealing with in China aren't going to be fixed in 90 days. This is far more systemic than that. And frankly, I'm highly suspicious of banner Chinese headlines about how much of this they're going to buy and what they're going to do over here. And 2 or 3 years later, we find it's pennies in the dollar. So I think we're in it for the long haul here. And I actually believe that Mr. Trump's colleagues recognize that this is a heavy lift, and we're going to be at it for a while, because the most important thing for the national security interests of the United States, that is inclusive of its economy and the companies within that economy, many of whom are members of the U.S. Taiwan Business Council, is that their intellectual property, their trade secrets, their ability to operate in the supply chain and have their critical technologies protected is essential. It represents an existential threat to their very existence. So I think we sort of worked through that a bit. We are seeing some shift in the supply chain. I'm not going to do your homework for you if you are, so please don't ask me what the data is on to give you all the specifics. You can see it right here in MOEA's release data, the Ministry of Economic Affairs release data every month. But what we've seen basically is a shift in about 30 cents of every dollar away from China into Southeast Asia over the last 2 years for tracked investment. Taiwan tracked investment. And in essence, the analysis certainly that we have in-house is that what's happening is you've got about 35 to 40 cents in the dollar still going into China. And what we attribute that to is constructed concrete facilities that are already there that require new equipment, maybe a new building or two, but it's already established boots on the ground. The next 30 to 35 that was used to be flowing into China is now shifting away. That money might normally be expected to go further west or to some new facility. Now it's going out of China. Now these Taiwan supply chain companies, they're looking at Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, India. That's where these guys are going. That part of the money is now shifting. So overall, you've got a shift where the majority of the money was flowing into China, let's say 65 to 70 cents in the dollar. Now it's 65 to 70 cents of the dollar flowing to somewhere else, right? And 35 to 40 cents of the dollar. Or let's say a third of a dollar still flowing into China. So a significant change. Again, I want to be clear, attributing it to two things. One, the rising cost for manufacturing in China as a function of the fact that, you know, it's getting more expensive to make things there. And two, the geostrategic risk and the direction that the overall relationship between the US and China, and indeed the rest of the world and China, is heading, and the interest on the part of supply chain companies to shift and to balance that risk out a wee bit more than it has been. Can I speak for a couple more minutes, Steve? Is that all right?
Yeah.
The IC industry, of course, dominates Taiwan's geopolitical and economic leadership. Taiwan's semiconductor is a monster, and it will continue to be. It is run as well as any company in the world. I'll never tire of saying that. Morris Chung did an essential service to the fortunes and future of Taiwan, political fortunes and future, by building that company, because it makes it an essential partner to the United States, given our reliance on IC production out of Taiwan for our own critical industries here in the United States. TSMC is right at the heart of that. A very good book that was actually written by a guy who worked for the Semiconductor Equipment Manufacturing Association called Silicon Shield. It came out about 25 years ago. I actually just reordered a copy since mine went walkabout. But it stands the test of time. And what it really gets to at its heart is America's reliance on Taiwan as a semiconductor manufacturer of critical chips for American products. Makes it an essential strategic partner. It's not fully understood, regrettably. We're starting to try and wrap our arms around it. It would be a tragedy if we had a blockade or some sort of military confrontation in the Taiwan Strait, the supply chain got cut, and we really came to understand how quickly our supply, our manufacturing lines would come to a halt if Taiwan was cut off from the supply chain. Look at how quickly ZTE came crashing down when it couldn't get hold of its chips. It was days. That's how well these inventories are managed. And ZTE is obviously a Chinese example, but these things work both ways, as I'm sure you're all aware. Apple, Intel, Microsoft, Google, Qualcomm, Micron, Corning, all these US tech companies, as a matter of public record, are hugely vested in Taiwan from a research and development and an entrepreneurial standpoint. Apple, obviously, is a product, branded product. You can buy, but you've also got critical suppliers like Corning. They make the glass. Corning makes this glass. It's called Gorilla Glass, right? Absolute leader, right? A lot of money to be made. They're all there. They're doing their work in cooperation with Taiwan. So let's pivot a wee bit and just touch on what Deepa had asked: Taiwan's digital future. What is Taiwan trying to do on the digital side? Taiwan's Digital Nation and Innovation Economic Development Program. Say that five times fast. Running from 2017 to 2025 is well underway. It's a Tsai DPP government initiative. It's rather, but it's a bit more usefully known as DigiPlus. So I use that. I do. It's designed to catalyze Taiwan's evolution into a network nation with all of the commercial and personal transformation that implies. The goal for DigiPlus is to bring Taiwan economic activity in the digital economy to 200 billion plus by 2025, while increasing the broadband penetration to over 80% for digital lifestyle services and increasing speeds beyond 2 gigabytes, so over 90% of the country. So it's ambitious. It certainly is ambitious. How's it going to get there? Well, it's going to require a dual-headed approach. Obviously, legislation from the Lifa UN, and we saw some proactive movement and positive proactive movement in this past year from the LY with the Financial Technology Development and Innovation Experimentation Act. Again, say that five times fast. And the Act for the Recruitment and Employment of Foreign Professionals. One, fintech. Taiwan could do an excellent job in fintech. And two, it's critical but highly politicized issue of managed immigration, right? To positively impact the pool of employees that Taiwan has. Taiwan has it's an existential threat, its demographic situation. The growth in people is just not significant enough. Immigration could be an important part of that if it's appropriately managed. And of course, immigration has an important impact, it's quantifiable, on entrepreneurialism, the construction of new businesses. Again, if you get those policies right, you can create to Google. You can create other, obviously Google's a massive example, but I think you get the point that I'm making. Immigration, again, managed immigration is an important positive role player in a country's present and future economic environment. AIT, the American Institute of Taiwan, and the National Development Council have been doing an excellent job too in cooperating on the digital economy. The US's Global Cities Team Challenge has also had an impact on Taiwan's digital landscape by pushing to create a single platform for entrepreneurs, for technology firms and local governments to develop smart city solutions for tougher municipal problems. Taipei and Taichung have already signed up. I don't doubt that Kaohsiung and the others will follow in time. It doesn't cost anything as far as I know, but I think importantly, it creates a unified platform for these cities and municipal areas to assist entrepreneurs in constructing solutions for domestic, local peoples. And then finally, the Asian Silicon Valley Initiative, which many of you might know is part of Tsai Ing-wen's 5+2. And that's really focused on innovation, R&D, creating a robust startup ecosystem with entrepreneurs, with access to funds, qualified employees, and modern facilities. We haven't heard as much about that of late, but nevertheless, it remains an important government policy. One concern I have, and then I'm going to stop. The one concern I have relates to Taiwan's connectivity with the rest of the world. Taiwan only has, as far as I'm aware, one undersea cable that connects it. One. It does some of its broadband through satellite, but that is an issue, because the Chinese could do this very easily in a confrontation situation, and Taiwan would be cut off from its principal broadband connection. From my understanding, CHT, Zhonghua Telecom, whose responsibility it would be to lay another of these cables, believes that it's too expensive to lay more, but to me this is a national security issue, and it should be elevated out of the parochial interests of the company into a broader debate on how to ensure that Taiwan, in any situation, in all situations, can retain connectivity in the bandwidth it needs for peaceful evolution, and God forbid anything that comes in underneath that. Thank you all very much.